is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. Headlines. Iran says the removal of U.S. sanctions against Tehran is the main purpose of its upcoming talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. Russian President Vladimir Putin slams Western actions in the Black Sea region as destabilizing, dangerous, and provocative. Also coming up, Palestinian prisoner Muqtad al-Qawasma ends his 113-day hunger strike after Israel agreed to release him next February. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's lead negotiator in the upcoming P4+1 talks in Vienna has met with officials from the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. Ali Bagheri Kani has described the meetings as positive while reiterating Tehran's position that the talks will aim at the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions. Amina Taylor has more from London.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bagheri Kani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK Foreign Ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
Political commentator Jason Nure believes all U.S. efforts at this point is dedicated to continuing its maximum pressure campaign on Iran rather than returning to the nuclear deal itself.
I think that the United States will only actually return to the JCPOA once it can cause further harm to Iran. Basically, what I think, in my opinion, is that the current unjust sanctions that were placed by the previous U.S. administration are not going to be removed. Essentially, the U.S. is going to leave these sanctions in place and maybe even demand more. I mean, if the U.S. simply wanted to return honest and fairly, it really wouldn't have required seven rounds of talk. All they could do is simply return to the previous agreement with the previously agreed to levels of sanctions or no sanctions, etc. But it's very clear that the U.S. has not done that. So I think that this sends a definite message that the U.S. is not willing to act honorably or even in a most basic, decent manner. I think that the United States is going to continue to try to pressure Iran into accepting new sanctions or a new set of sanctions, etc. So I don't see the U.S. is going back to the regular deal. I think all U.S. effort at this point is dedicated towards trying to place, even more of this maximum pressure campaign on Iran, and it's not going to return to the original agreement.
Elsewhere, Russia says it has intercepted a British spy plane near the Crimean Peninsula amid fears over the West's increasing military activity there.
Between 12 and 3 p.m., a British Air Force RC-135 reconnaissance aircraft attempted to approach the state border of the Russian Federation near the southwestern part of the Crimean Peninsula. In order to control its actions, a Russian Air Force Su-30 fighter jet from the on-duty force was lifted at a distance of about 30 kilometers from the state border. Russian Su-30 fighter jet approached the spy plane, after which the British plane changed its course away from the Russian border.
The Russian Defense Ministry spokesman described the spying operation as part of the military activity of the United States and its NATO allies in the Black Sea region. Russian President Vladimir Putin voiced concern about the incident, denouncing the West's actions in the Black Sea region as destabilizing, dangerous, and provocative. The incident follows a confrontation in June when a British warship sailed off Crimea's coast, drawing a fierce response from the Russian Navy. Crimea reunited with Russia following a referendum back in 2014, but Western countries recognized the area as part of Ukraine. Belarus has threatened to retaliate against any new EU sanctions against Minsk, saying any such move will lead to shutting down of the transit of natural gas via the country.
We have increased the volumes of natural gas pumped via Belarus. The Yamal-Europe pipeline is full. We are heating Europe and they are threatening that they will close the border. And what if we block the supply of natural gas there? If they impose additional sanctions on us, indigestible and unacceptable for us, we must respond.
The warning comes amid a migrant crisis on the Belarusian border with EU member Poland. Lukashenko also claimed that the migrants on the border had been receiving weapons and explosives from conflict-hit eastern Ukraine. The president called on the Belarusian military to remain vigilant. Lukashenko was reacting to the EU threat that it would hit Belarus with fresh sanctions next week over the migrant crisis.
The European Union will expand and tighten its sanctions against Lukashenko's regime. This is what we will decide at our foreign ministers' meeting in Brussels on Monday.
Mas noted that there are other options on the table, including the expansion of current sanctions, especially the economic ones. Lukashenko, on the other hand, accuses the EU of trying to shift the blame on the country to justify its new sanctions. Meanwhile, Poland accused Minsk of state terrorism for allegedly using intimidation to force migrants to breach the border. Belarus, however, says Poland is violating international norms by blocking the migrants and beating them back with force. Thousands of asylum seekers remain stuck near the Belarusian border with Poland in freezing weather. Guards and police forces are deployed on the Polish side to block the migrants from entering into the EU. Palestinian prisoner Miqdad al-Gawasma ends his nearly 4 months of hunger strike after the Israeli regime decided to release him.
Miqdad's demand was quite normal as he refused to eat and drink, which is everyone's right. And it is his absolute right to enjoy freedom. When his right to freedom was violated and he went on hunger strike, he was quite sure about what he was doing and he knew that he was right. But unfortunately, we are living under tyranny and oppression, and he was arrested just because the local officer issued an order for his arrest without any legal justification. These people are truly free people, and they should be looked up to.
The Palestinian Prisoners Information Office said the regime has agreed to free Gawasma, that is, in February next year. It said the agreement was reached after long negotiations between a group of Hamas prisoners and the Israeli prison service. Gawasma was on hunger strike for 113 days before being taken to the ICU due to his worsening conditions. Hamas has hailed his resistance, saying the decision to release him shows Israel's failure to discourage Palestinians from fighting for freedom. Political commentator Paul Larudi says Miqdad al-Gawasma has proven that there is always a way to practice resistance, even inside a prison.
This incident and others like it demonstrate that there's always a means of resistance, even if you're a prisoner. And even if your hands are tied behind you, there's always a way to resist. And resistance always, is an effective way to get what you want, including freedom, including the freedom of a free Palestine. What Gawasmi did was to show his willingness to resist at great sacrifice to him, potentially the ultimate sacrifice, and the Israelis decided it was not worth it, that whatever justification they thought they had for this, they investigated it and they decided that it's not worth it to create a martyr, so they released him. It's a success story.
Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah says Israel is suffering from existential fear, mainly due to the strength of the resistance in Lebanon. Maryam Saleh reports from the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
Hezbollah Secretary General stressed that the resistance in Lebanon has prevented full U.S. hegemony over Lebanon and has prevented civil war. Underlining the achievements of the resistance, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that one of the most tangible results is the fact that Israel is deterred from launching aggressions and even fears the strength of the resistance.
For the first time, Israel is living in a deeply rooted state of fear and concern for its existence. The elites in this entity are asking about the legitimacy of the entity's existence and the ability to exist. They are trying to get some oxygen through normalization of ties with some Arab states, but deep in their minds, the Israelis know that all these countries cannot protect their occupation or forts from the men of the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the entire region.
Speaking at Hezbollah's Martyr Day celebration, Nasrallah said the main fear for the Israelis is that the resistance in Lebanon would invade the Galilee in northern occupied Palestine. Sayyid Nasrallah also criticized the Saudi campaign against Lebanon, saying a sovereign state would not accept any foreign dictates. The real problem is the crisis the Saudis have in Yemen, he said. The only way to stop it is to accept a ceasefire and lift the siege. Representatives of Lebanese political factions consider that the sacrifices of the martyrs of the resistance in Lebanon are evident for the entire region.
This is a historic day, not just for the resistance in Lebanon, but also for all the people from the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon to Palestine. Had it not been for the martyrs, the entire region would have been destroyed. The Zionists and the Takfiris are the same, supported by the US and Arab regimes. But we believe this sacred blood will liberate Palestine.
Families of the martyrs, for their part, stress that they would not back down.
The blood of our sons bore fruit, and we cannot back down now despite all the campaigns against us. Our children and grandchildren will continue to sacrifice their lives.
Said Nasrallah also reiterated that as the resistance liberated Lebanon from Israeli occupation, their next goal is full sovereignty and freedom from U.S. hegemony.
What began with the first martyrdom operation in November 1982 as a fight for freedom from Israeli occupation in Lebanon has transformed into a struggle for emancipation for the entire region. And what used to be a grassroots resistance in a small Mediterranean country is now backed by an alliance on a regional scale, ready to face new U.S.-Israeli threats. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Turning elsewhere, the Ethiopian government has set out terms for possible talks with rebels in the northern Tigray region as fighting continues between the two sides. Addis Ababa says it wants the Tigray People's Liberation Front to stop its attacks on army forces and recognize the legitimacy of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. The government is also asking the TPLF to leave Amhara and Afar, the two areas it has captured during the recent fighting. The rebel group, which has made consistent advances over the past weeks, rejects leaving the areas it has taken from the federal forces. Ethiopia has been mired in conflict since November last year, when the Prime Minister sent forces into Tigray. Thousands of people have died so far, while many more have been displaced. Sudan's army chief has named a new governing council following the coup last month that dissolved the transitional government. Abdel Fattah al-Burhan has retained his position as the head of the body, dubbed the Sovereign Council. This is while the political coalition that was sharing power with the military before the coup is excluded from the new 14-member body. Soon after the announcement, protesters hit the streets in the capital, Khartoum, and several other major cities, slamming the move. The United Nations has expressed concern over the developments in Sudan.
We're obviously taking a look at these developments. I would say they're very concerning. We want to see a return to the transition as quickly as possible. We want to see the release from house arrest of Prime Minister Hamdok, as well as all other politicians and leaders that have been detained.
The UN Security Council held a closed-door meeting on Sudan but did not issue a joint statement on the issue. Britain's UN envoy, however, said the military's unilateral action goes against the spirit and the letter of the Sudanese constitutional declaration. Burhan dissolved the civilian cabinet of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok on October 25th, citing the risk of a civil war. The cabinet had been formed under a power-sharing deal reached with the military after the oust of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir in 2019. The cabinet was supposed to rule the country until an election in 2023 that would transition the country into civilian rule. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
Be English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
A coalition of watchdog groups estimated that fossil fuel industry representatives have a larger presence at COP26 than officials from any single country, a finding that further intensified environmentalist concerns about the legitimacy of the high-stakes climate summit. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jack Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading
fossil fuel lobbyists have larger presence at COP26 than any single country report shows. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A coalition of watchdog groups estimated on Monday, November 8, that fossil fuel industry representatives have a larger presence at COP26 than officials from any single country, a finding that further intensified environmentalist concerns about the legitimacy of the high-stakes climate summit. After poring over a 1,600-page United Nations list of approved COP26 attendees, the coalition led by Global Witness published an analysis showing that at least 503 fossil fuel lobbyists have been admitted to the summit in Glasgow, Scotland. That means the oil and gas industry, the principal driver of the crisis at COP26, was ostensibly convened to tackle and officially has a bigger delegation at a conference than Brazil, which has the largest national presence at COP26 with 479 representatives. Fossil fuel industry influence peddlers at COP26 also far outnumber the representatives of nations that have been most impacted by the climate crisis over the past two decades, including Bangladesh, Mozambique, and Haiti. Prominent industry attendees, according to the new analysis, include delegates from over 100 fossil fuel companies, such as the oil giants Shell and BP, who openly stated their affiliation attending the talks as the party of country delegations or with business groups like the International Chamber of Commerce. The analysis notes, for example, 1 in 8 delegates from Russia, 300-strong delegation were from fossil fuel industry, while lobbyists were also included in Canada's and Brazil's official delegations. In total, 27 different official country delegations included fossil fuel lobbyists. Pacobo Sabido, a campaigner for Corporate Europe Observatory, CEO, one of the groups behind the new research, said in a statement that COP26 is being sold as the place to raise ambition, but it's crawling with fossil fuel lobbyists whose only ambition is to stay in business. The likes of Shell and BP are inside these talks despite openly admitting to upping their production of fossil fuels. Sabio added, if we are serious about raising ambition, then fossil fuel lobbyists should be shut out of the talks and out of our national capitals. The analysis found that fossil fuel lobbies dwarf the official indigenous presence at COP26 by around 2 to 1, heightening fears that constituencies with life or death stakes in the outcome are being shut out of the summit. Tassanim Esop, the executive director of Climate Action Network, CAN, which represents more than 1,500 organizations in over 130 countries, told The Guardian on Monday, November 8, civil society voices are critical to the outcome of COP, but we have not been able to do our jobs. If participation and inclusion are the measure of legitimacy, then we are on very shaky grounds. The Global Witness research was published days after more than 100,000 demonstrators took to the streets of COP26 to protest the inadequate pledges that have emerged from the conference thus far and demand transformative change, not false solutions that cater to the industries responsible for climate destruction. Murray Wolfe, the gas campaign leader at Global Witness, said on Monday, November 8, that with the world quickly running out of time to avert climate disaster, this COP absolutely must be a success. The case for meaningful global action must not be diverted by a festival of polluters and their mouthpieces, who have no interest in seeing the changes we need to protect people and the planet, said Wolfe. The presence of hundreds of those being paid to push the toxic interests of polluting fossil fuel companies will only increase the skepticism of climate activists who see these hawks as more evidence of global leaders dithering and delaying, he said.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
The scenes presented by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy of them thwarting the American attempt to hijack an Iranian oil tanker in the Sea of Oman are so immensely important that I doubt just one episode is enough for me to emphasize their significance. Footage released by the Iranian state TV showed units of guard boats aiming their weapons at an American warship and forcing them to withdraw from the spot of these units while they were leading and directing the Iranian tanker were not normal. The incident is worth stopping and thinking thoroughly about in terms of the level of engagement and the specificity of the parties involved. Also, in terms of the sensitivity of the location of the standoff in the Sea of Oman and what it means in terms of the open confrontation between Iran and its opponents in that region. The noteworthy point which deserves focus and follow-up and analysis was beyond the apparent event in itself. The operation itself could be placed in the category of special maneuvers carried out by airborne units that carried out a landing of an airborne group on the surface of the oil tanker, forcing the tanker's crew to head towards the depths of the Iranian territorial waters. All of this took place in an open, controlled, and monitored area within the dominion of the U.S. 5th Fleet units in the Sea of Oman, which operated based on their naval, missile, and air capabilities. However, the Revolutionary Guard Corps units in the second phase of their operation, which was based on expelling U.S. naval vessels from the area, and through their quick reaction and immediate response to deal with an emergency and unfamiliar event, proved that they were distinguished by remarkable readiness. The sensitivity of the Iranian intervention through this special operation and the readiness of its navy will inevitably be more dangerous for the U.S. in the event of another confrontation that might just escalate into a broader clash. Hence, Iran was able to emphasize that it is a key and influential player in one of the most sensitive areas in the world. Indeed, it has proven to be the undisputed first player in a strategic clash scene in which the most powerful forces at an international level are involved. Iran asserted that when its interests, national security, and status are exposed to any danger or targeting, it is ready to go above and beyond whatever the level of confrontation is. At a time when we see major powers finding it difficult to confront U.S. influence, whose army is ranked among the strongest in the world, we see that Iran considers confrontation a responsibility, a duty, a right, and a valid option. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The United States continues to play pirates in the Persian Gulf waters through an Iranian-American naval battle which occurred last month in the Sea of Oman when American forces seized one of its oil tankers before the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy was able to recover it with an airdrop, as we saw last week. While U.S. officials have conveyed a completely different story from the Iranian one, saying that Tehran is the one who is holding a Vietnamese-flagged tanker, it seems that all doors were shut to the possibility of reducing tensions between the two sides, especially with America brandishing alternative options, perhaps military ones, they say, forgetting who they are actually going up against. Pentagon first denied that this showdown actually took place, but they were then hit hard when the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps released video footage of the encounter just last week. The footage focuses on Iranian movements to board and direct the ship's course and omits the earlier attempts by U.S. troops to seize the oil. To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Mohammad Sultan Najad, academic and researcher at Tehran University. Thanks a million for being with us, Dr. Sultan Najad. Now, the conflict between the Iranian and the American accounts regarding the tanker incident in the Sea of Oman will for sure just exacerbate tension between both sides. But, however, can the Pentagon still refuse, how can they just refute the Iranian narrative and the Iranian story after the visual evidence presented to the entire world by the Iranian state TV?
Okay, thank you for having me. As you just said, we have just conflicting narratives by Iranian and the American sides about this incident. The thing is that at least Iran has showed some evidence to be relied upon, and this is visualized how the things have gone. So this is something that we can at least see some evidence supporting that. But American narrative seems like unsubstantiated, and I have not seen anything more than some claims about what they have said about their own side of the story. The thing is that I think totally what is disappointing is the United States' type of reaction to the waters close to Iran. And this is something that would just make things much worse. And in my opinion, there was like a problem resolved that the United States revoked it. And then by such actions of, as you said, can be termed piracy. They are trying to make things even worse and just proposing some narratives that they are not acceptable and they cannot support it. So I'm regretted about what I see in this condition. I think the United States could act more responsibly if it just nuclear deal, and they didn't hesitate to revive the nuclear deal after the Trump went. And now we see the two countries in such escalations that I don't think would bear any fruits.
Dr. Sultan Nejad, something interesting was said by the Americans after the incident where Washington actually issued a threat last week through its Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, that it might resort to what it called alternative options, maybe including military ones, against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Is that an inevitable option if the two sides fail in the upcoming agreement or in the upcoming talks to try and revive the agreement of the JCPOA?
Well, I think that option would be a remote possibility regarding the facts on the ground. I don't think the United States has the stomach to do such a thing about Iran. Not that the United States does not have the military power to do that, but the consequences would be, you know, very high for the United States, and we all know that Iran has a formidable military, and Iran can retaliate in very strong ways. Iran has shown its ability to respond to the United States' aggressions in the past. Just I make a reference to what Iran did with launching the missiles for the United States bases in Iraq that led to like brain injury for many number of Americans. And this was a fact that was seen by the world. So the United States actually hesitates to do such a thing. And again, I would see that if the United States does this and Iran would respond, it would have like these escalation mounted between the two countries, which is very destructive, especially for the United States because it is alien to their region, and the United States is already entangled in conflicts in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. The United States has recently managed to take out its troops from Afghanistan, and it would be unwise to start a new war in the region, particularly with a country like Iran, with a formidable military and also a population that is opposed to any foreign interference. So I do not think that that option would just be materialized by the United States. There is a wisdom in the United States. And the fact that the United States has resorted to negotiations with Iran and the negotiations went on, the United States, actually during the Trump administration, has this rationality to recognize Iran's rise. It was just out of the United States' desire avoid such a destructive eventuality. So I do not think that
Dr. Sultan Nejad, Iran requires for the reversal of steps that were taken by the United States of America for its nuclear program, a complete lifting of the sanctions. This is what Iran wants, because they are basically unilateral, punitive U.S. Measures here in order for them to actually join back the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. While Washington refuses to make any concessions in this regard, who has the higher bargaining hand here, and what is more pressuring measures that we can expect out of the Biden administration?
Well, again, I'm sorry that you're in such a situation that you're talking about these measures and countermeasures, about these leverages. Well, I think there would be much better options, but now that the United States has created such a bad situation and they're continuing this way down to like escalation with Iran, I would say that eventually Iran would have the upper hand, because you know Iran has many options. When Iran is restricting access of to some sites by for the like the international observers, it means that there are other sites that would be restricted by Iran upon its political decision. And then also you would see that Iran can increase its enrichment, its uranium enrichment level. It's already 60%. It can go higher and higher. The number of centrifuges, the kind of centrifuges can be improved. And all this would work like a leverage for Iran. And it is in a time that the United States has consumed all its options. Actually, the United States has implemented what it calls crippling sanctions towards Iran. But despite the sanctions, you would see that the country is going on. There is a heavy pressure on the economy.
So basically, what you're saying is very, very important. But basically, in 30 seconds, because we're actually out of time, but in 30 seconds, then why is this kind of negotiating talks important? Or what's the actual point out of it if the U.S. cannot commit itself to anything?
Well, I think it's a matter of legitimacy generation and legitimacy maintenance for Iran. I think Iran has a moral high ground here. Iran has a moral high ground. Everybody knows that Iran is just doing the right thing. Iran has kept its pledges towards the world community. We have all seen how Iran behaved vis-a-vis the United States, unlawful behaviors. So legally, again, Iran has the upper hand. So international legal instruments would support what Iran has done while condemning the United States' unilateral action of withdrawal from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Then again, in the political scene, you would see that there are countries that are supporting Iran's cause. Politically, Iran has, the high ground here. China is working with Iran, Russia is working with Iran, Europeans, despite their cooperation with the United States, but at least they are ready to just put some sort of political pressures on the White House to resume its commitments. Well, so I think
It seems that we are looking upon some very important couple of months to come between the Islamic Republic of Iran and its U.S. counterpart. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mohammad Sultan Nejad, academic and professor at Tehran University, for joining us on this matter. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, U.S. State Department notified Congress of a new $650 million arms sale to Saudi Arabia last week. The sale comes as the Biden administration continues to grapple with the U.S.-Saudi relationship that has been strained in recent years following the murder of U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi and Saudi Arabia's involvement in its absurd war on Yemen. Now, the sale will include 280 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles, which the State Department said are used for air defense capabilities and cannot be used to attack ground targets. U.S. lawmakers have criticized Riyadh for its involvement in the war on Yemen, while the U.S. is up to its neck in this conflict, which is considered one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters. These same U.S. lawmakers have refused to approve many military sales for the kingdom without assurances that U.S. equipment would not be used to kill civilians. Well, Yemeni cemeteries say otherwise, but when have U.S. officials ever said the truth? Biden reneges on vow to sell arms to Saudi Arabia in this following report.
In less than a week, the U.S. administration approved two arms deals to Saudi Arabia under the pretext of supporting the territorial defense of Saudi Arabia. It is not excluded that the two deals are a leap from the deteriorating relations between the Joe Biden administration and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, which have recently declined further as Washington blamed Riyadh for the high oil prices. The administration's approval of two U.S. arms deals to Saudi Arabia totaling $1.15 billion also coincided with rapid developments on the Yemeni oil and gas-rich Ma'rib front, where the Army Forces and the People's Committees and the Yemeni resistance on Sarullah took control of all the governorate's districts, with the exception of Ma'rib District, which includes the city of Ma'rib, the governorate's center, and the Wadi District. The resistance is now closer than ever to defeating the Saudi-Emirati alliance and its Western backers in the more than six-year-old war, which may explain the dispatch of the American envoy to Yemen, Timothy Lenderking, to the region, where his visits are limited to times when Saudi Arabia feels cornered and defeated to try and salvage the situation. The U.S. Department of Defense had announced last week that the State Department informed Congress its approval of a $650 million deal with Saudi Arabia, which includes 280 AIM-120C medium-range air-to-air missiles.
According to the State Department, these missiles are supposed to be used for defense purposes and cannot be used to, quote, attack targets on the ground, unquote, and is fully in line with the administration's pledge to engage in diplomacy, wait for it, to end the conflict in Yemen. I really fail to understand how any of this statement is compatible with simple common sense. But when has America's foreign policy ever made any sense? This deal is the second for Saudi Arabia under the Biden administration. Last week, the U.S. State Department notified Congress its approval of another $500 million military support services package. At the time, the State Department said the proposed transaction will support the foreign policy and national security objectives of the United States by helping to enhance the security of a friendly nation that remains an important force for political stability and economic growth in the Middle East. But the agreement, which includes support for the ongoing maintenance of a wide range of helicopters, including a future fleet of Boeing CH-47 Chinook aircrafts, violates Biden's pledge because these aircrafts are offensive ones. They are used to launch AIM-120 air-to-air missiles. To justify this, the State Department claimed that this deal would also provide protection for American soldiers and more than 70,000 American citizens working inside the kingdom, which in reality supports Saudi military aggression against Yemen rather than works to end it.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Washington is Dr. Ziad Al-Hafiz, author and former Secretary General of the Arab National Conference. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Ziad. Now, after it had withheld from selling weapons to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the U.S. State Department has approved the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued up to $650 million, with another package that was also approved last week up to $550 million for Saudi Arabia. So instead of actually pressuring Mohammed bin Salman to at least stop or halt the war, his aggression against Yemen, Biden just gave him 280 more weapons to ignite it even further. How is that finding peace in Yemen, as Biden always likes to say?
Well, thank you for having me on your program. And I think what you have said in your presentation of the segment is totally correct, that hardly ever U.S. foreign policy has made sense. I think the Biden administration is no different from previous administrations, where it says one thing and does exactly the opposite. Because in this particular instance, for instance, the Biden administration is the result of a coalition of forces that have conflicting agendas, and these forces have put him in the White House. But now, chicken has come to roost, so to speak. And let's say the military-industrial complex or the companies that manufacture arms are requiring their pound of flesh, so to speak. And this goes against the peace between quotation marks rhetoric that he was trying to advocate to end the peace, to end the war in Yemen, as well as his colleagues in the Democratic Party in Congress. But the realities on the ground say otherwise, that they have to pay heed to those donors who have made them what they are when they were facilitated the reach to power. The second thing is, in the actual tension that exists between the administration and the Crown Prince, we have seen it reach to almost a climax last week in Lebanon, where the Crown Prince has declared for all intents and purposes an economic war on Lebanon, mm-hmm. and is forcing the council, the Gulf members of the to follow suit and join into the blockade, economic blockade of Lebanon. This goes against to the strategy of the United States and Lebanon, that wants to keep it as it is and not having it collapse, because otherwise it will go indirectly into the sphere of influence of Iran and Hezbollah, and this is what it doesn't want.
What we saw is pretty much of either a confusion in the Biden administration or actually a strategy, a new strategy by Biden. Because after the Trump administration's friendly, very friendly, if I may, relationship with Mohammed bin Salman and Riyadh, the Biden administration kind of recalculated their approach to Saudi Arabia, which is a country with severe human rights violations. But they are Washington's closest allies in West Asia. So is this Biden's way of maybe upping the ante against Iran, who he will have talks with maybe soon enough?
Well, yes and no. I mean, don't forget that this stance towards Saudi Arabia started with the Obama administration when he wanted to recalibrate the whole Middle East, and that was the foundation of the Arab Spring. And the Arab petromonarchies in the Gulf were next in line, so to speak, to follow suit. But it didn't happen. Trump had a personal good relation with the Crown Prince and Saudi Arabia. But that doesn't mean that the administration followed suit and also that the Congress followed suit. So you have to be a little bit careful about how we define the relationship between the various administrations. Biden is a continuation of Obama's administration in that term of having, different perspective from previous administrations about the relationship with Saudi Arabia. Suddenly, for ideological purposes or for any other purpose, the issues of human rights, political freedoms, etc., is becoming at the forefront of his policy with petromonarchies. And I don't think it's going to succeed, because real politics requires that he follows another track. And I don't think there is a strategy in the United States or in the Foreign State Department. They are pragmatic to the point of responding to events on a day-to-day basis without a clear view of what's going to happen next. And this has happened since the invasion of Iraq, where they have lost the initiative and they have become subservient to the events on the ground initiated by their opponents, and they have to decide to how to respond to that. In the present situation, with the various, let's say, hot dossiers that the United States is facing in the region, the discussion with Iran, the issue with Hezbollah, and the war on Yemen, at the center of all this is the security of the state of Israel. So all the policies of the United States are guided to help Israel, which is in a difficult situation because of its inability.
Does this analysis actually maybe support the point of the U.S. envoy to Yemen, Tim Lenderking's visit? He just landed in the region, bearing an initiative apparently aimed at reversing the developments that Ansarullah did in the northern city of Ma'rib in Yemen. Why is it so important for the U.S. that the Yemeni resistance stays put and not fully take Ma'rib?
Because for geostrategic purposes, if you take Ma'rib, you also control the whole of Yemen, and when you control the whole of Yemen, you control the entrance to the Red Sea, and that is a geostrategic no-no for the United States, because all the Red Sea, the Suez Canal, and the access to Europe from that ceiling becomes in the hands of hostile powers to the United States. And that's why it is extremely important for the United States to keep, in the best case scenario, Yemen from falling to the hands of its opponents, and in the worst case scenario, to keep the war dragging as much as possible so nobody can have a direct claim on that geostrategic position, notwithstanding the fact that Yemen is sitting on an ocean of oil and gas, which in contrast or compared to those of the Saudi Arabia, no new discoveries have been made in Saudi Arabia, and therefore it's facing the issue of depletion of reserves. Whereas in Yemen, you may have a new boom for the oil industry. And that's why the issue of Yemen is not just a passing fade, and has extremely important strategic importance.
This gives a lot of points, Dr. Hafiz, for how Yemen might actually be the rock that Saudi Arabia might stumble on in the region of the Arabian Peninsula. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ziad Hafiz, former Secretary General of the Arab National Conference, for joining us from Washington to talk about the new U.S. arms deal with the Al Saud in the Arabian Peninsula. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
In the limelight.
If we continue not acting against the real cause of the climate crisis, the capitalist mode of production and the capitalist worldview, they will take it as a social license to carry on with collapse, says Joao Camargo, writer, in an article titled Capitalism's Only Plan for Climate is Collapse. Stay tuned for more. The recent flurry of announcements over ambitious action by governments during the COP26 in Glasgow has been justly received with skepticism by climate justice activists and the general public, and enthusiastic support by the media in general. During this same period, important revelations of the massive gap in terms of necessary emission cuts and countries' plans emerged as the broader rejection of greenwashing became pervasive. The narrative of false solutions and green capitalism doesn't work. Recently, the revelation that over 800 oil and gas wells are being planned for drilling still this year and in 2022, and the report Drill Baby Drill makes it clear that the proceedings of COP26 are mostly